If you love the History Extra podcast, make sure you follow us to keep up to date and get all the latest episodes. Thanks for your support, and I do hope you enjoy this episode.
This episode is brought to you by Indeed. We're driven by the search for better, but when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/History Extra. Just go to Indeed.com/History Extra right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
Hello, and welcome to the first BBC History Magazine podcast of 2012. I'm Rob Attar, Deputy Editor of the magazine. Happy New Year to all our listeners. Don't forget, BBC History Magazine is on sale in all good newsagents and on subscription. Visit our website, historyextra.com, for more information. Or you can follow us at twitter.com/historyextra or facebook.com/historyextra. Coming up this week, we have...
I think what he is aware of is the power of the monarchy as a symbol, as a unifying factor. And he plays that card, I think, very well.
That was Dennis Judd on King George VI.
And the gold that comes out of that region is of an incredibly high quality, and huge amounts of it too.
That was Gus Casely-Hayford on the Asante Kingdom. George VI, second son of King George V, came to the throne in 1936 after his brother Edward VIII abdicated. February the 6th, 1952 was the date that King George VI died. And as we approach the 60th anniversary of this event, editor Dave Musgrove has been speaking to Professor Dennis Judd to find out how this man went from the shy stutterer, as portrayed in the film The King's Speech, to the statesman who helped keep the nation's morale high in the Second World War.
We're talking about George VI, King of Great Britain, Ireland, and sometime Emperor of India as
yes.
well, who's recently sort of come back into the frame because of The King's Speech, the film that explored his stutter. So the first question is, how important a figure is George VI? Does he deserve to be back in the limelight, do you think?
Well, yes, I think he does, and not because of his stutter, although that was very interesting, obviously, and the film dealt with it, I think, brilliantly. But I think that the main point is that when his elder brother, Edward VIII, abdicated, you know, there was a lot of people who thought, well, you know, is the monarchy got anywhere else to go? Maybe this is the beginning of the end. And for somebody who was, I think, very painfully shy, had a stutter, was not perhaps, you know, the most brilliantly intelligent of people, I think he surprised everybody by the very effective way he dealt with his new post, despite lots of misgivings at the beginning. And I think he, in a way, together with his wife, Elizabeth, and, of course, their two daughters, rescues the monarchy in many ways from doldrums. And remember, the mid-30s, there's lots of socialists and communists. The Communist Party's on the rise, party in response to fascism. Not everybody is enamoured with the monarchy at all. But I think he, in a way, saves it.
Does he build on what George V did? Because George V was... you could see him as a modernizer in some way, in trying to bring the monarchy into the 20th century. Does he sort of build on what George V did, or does he go a different way?
Well, I mean, he's very interesting. He's in many ways an intensely conservative person, although he was quite open-minded, I think, about, say, the new Labour government of 45 to 51. And to call him a modernizer might be pushing it a bit, but I think what he is aware of is the power of the monarchy as a symbol, as a unifying factor. And he plays that card, I think, very well. I mean, the press and the media present him and Queen Elizabeth and the two daughters, the two princesses, as, you know, an ideal nuclear family, very like you. You know, he's interested in collecting stamps and they pat dogs' heads and, you know, they seem to sometimes to lead an ordinary life, even though, of course, they are, in a way, fabulously rich and with an extraordinary lineage. So I think the media and he work together in such a way that a much more cosy, domestic, reassuring image of the monarchy is presented, a little bit like Albert and Victoria, you know, a monogamous couple, well-behaved children, doing their duty, not messing about, you know, if there's no drugs or drunkenness or the sort of rather scandalous behaviour which Edward VIII got up to at various times when he was Prince of Wales. It's in a way a clean sweep and a fresh start, rather puritanical image in some ways. But remember, if that coincides with the war, when people were inevitably going to cut down on living standards and have hardships, that fits in very well.
And what about the shyness and the stuttering then? Because how does that play with him being sort of in cahoots with the media and presenting that image? Because that must have been quite difficult.
But it was difficult. And I think that when it seemed inevitable that Edward VIII would be forced to abdicate, there were people in the establishment, as you know, who had grave misgivings about George VI. They thought he was, in some ways, quite a backward personality, that he had no sort of vivacity, that he would he was dull, that he might not be up to the job. And, of course, the stutter was part of that, because a lot of people had heard these painful pauses in speeches, you know, almost inarticulate sort of presentations sometimes. But Lionel Logue does make a really big difference, and through various techniques and breathing properly and all sorts of other things. And I think it's more like therapy in a way. It's more like psychotherapy that Logue gives him as well. Some of his battered confidence is rebuilt, and he emerges from all this with a far surer touch than he would have done if Lionel Logue had not given him lots of speech therapy.
That moment that you see in the King's Speech, in which it is based on real life, where he gives the closing address at the British Empire Exhibition in 1925.
Yes.
Was that an important moment? Did people listen to that and think, crikey, this chap doesn't sound too good?
I think they did. I think it was a disaster. And, of course, Logue was in the crowd, and Logue heard the speech, and Logue turned to somebody and said, I think I could help that man. So Logue is already thinking, this is terrible, but I can make a difference. I think it was a bit of a turning point, yeah. Mm.
Do we know where this stutter came from? Was it because he had such a strange childhood, in a way?
I think it was because he had a strange childhood. I mean, he, in some ways, he had the worst of both parents. I mean, he had an extremely dominating and irascible and, quite frankly, bullying father. George V was a tyrant, really, to his children in many ways. He could be, you know, loving in a gruff sort of way, but I don't think he really gave them a great deal of loving support. And Queen Mary, George VI's mother, you know, was rather a, well, cold and distant personality, very little warm physical contact between them. And I think that George VI's elder brother, Edward, who becomes, of course, Edward VIII, is like the star in the family. I mean, he does have vivacity. I mean, I don't think he's very bright either. I don't think he's an amazing intellect or anything. But I think he outshines George VI all the time. As they're growing up, George VI is the slightly backward, inarticulate, not very confident younger brother. So I think all these things conspire to make him unsure about presenting himself to the world. And a stammer or a stutter is exactly that. The person who suffers from it is unsure about relating to the world because they have misgivings about their own quality.
Mm. But then, I guess a formative experience for him would have been his time in the Navy.
Yes.
In the 1910s.
Sure.
When he went off to Naval College and presumably had a chance to prosper and flourish. And what I didn't realise was he was actually at the Battle of Jutland.
Absolutely.
In 1916, which must have been an important moment.
It was. He was in one of the gun turrets helping fire at the German fleet. No, I think this is one of the great moments of his early manhood life, really, that he did actually see service in this way. There's no question about him being, you know, quite courageous and doing his duty and being an efficient naval officer. I think he was quite good at that. Mm. But that seemed to be, at one level, all he was destined to be. Not much more than that. And then suddenly circumstances promote him to this, almost the most famous job in the world, really.
Yeah. How important was the fact that he actually saw active service when he became king? Did that give him something that Edward didn't have?
Well, Edward did see active service. In fact, he was in the army in the First World War. I came across a bit of diary he wrote the other day. I mean, his pathetic, cramped hand, sort of very boring, really. We marched 10 miles, it rained all the time, sort of thing, and that's it. So he did see service, but George VI, I suppose, was slightly more glamorous, really, the Battle of Jutland and all the rest of it. And I think it was terribly important. I think the fact that he is frequently portrayed as wearing naval officer's uniform is very important. And during the war, it's an incredibly reassuring symbol. There's Churchill in his rather sort of outre, baggy, aristocratic sort of politician's clothes. And there next to him is this trim, beautifully turned out naval officer.
Mm. So moving the story on, so in 1936, he suddenly becomes king. And presumably it was unexpected to him. You know, he wasn't being kept in touch with what was happening with his brother, was he, up until the last moment? And then there's this famous quote where he says, "I'm thoroughly unprepared for this." Was he thoroughly unprepared, or would actually every second son of a monarch been having to sort of learn the ropes as they go?
Yes, well, thoroughly unprepared is perhaps an exaggeration. I think what he's really saying is, I don't want to do the job.
Right.
I'm really a naval officer, and that's what I can do best, and I don't want to take on all these other responsibilities. I mean, Edward VIII, when he became king, was hardly a model monarch. I mean, his government soon began to believe that he wasn't reading the state papers at all, that they'd come back with, you know, stains of wine glasses on them and, you know, clearly unread. So, I mean, we're not talking about amazingly high standards here. Of course, George V had high standards for reading state papers and keeping in touch with his government and all the rest of it. But I mean, the things he'd done and the experiences he's had, of course, made him more or less adequately prepared. I think it's a statement about his lack of confidence.
A couple of years after he comes to power, the situation with Germany becomes very difficult, and the appeasement policy started. Yes. And George is a fan of appeasement, isn't he? But that could have gone wrong for him, presumably.
Well, it could have, except that most of the establishment were actually fans of appeasement. I think what we tend to forget is that it is obviously the beauty of hindsight, is that the appeasement lobby, both in Britain and within, say, the Dominions, like Australia and Canada to some extent, even the United States, I mean, they were very strong, and it did seem to be a popular policy. I mean, when Chamberlain comes back from Munich waving his bit of paper, he's not booed, he's cheered by huge crowds. People are greatly relieved. It's like an enormous tension has been released. So appeasement, for a while, was very popular, until, of course, it manifestly failed to work. It then could have gone wrong, I suppose, for George VI, except that everybody knew that he wasn't formulating policy. And I think the fact that he supports the appeasement policy is actually symptomatic of his being very loyal to his prime ministers and his different governments that he serves with. I mean, he was extremely loyal, of course, devoted to Churchill, and was slightly anxious when Attlee took over in 1945 as the new Labour prime minister. But he soon became really quite closely linked to Attlee as well. He thought he was, you know, a man of integrity trying to do the right thing. Perhaps not all of it he agreed with. But so I think he's a very loyal person. And I think what he's doing is articulating government policy as he sees it, and he thinks that's his duty. His duty is not to criticise government policy; it's to support it.
Mm. So, how important was he in the war? Because we have the main image we have of him is of touring around bombed out cities with the Queen and shaking hands and generally expressing sadness, presumably about what's. I mean, was that significant? Did people respect that? Did people admire that? Was he important for morale?
I think he was, and I think he was because he did seem to be an ordinary... I know this sounds ridiculous for a king emperor to say he's an ordinary sort of person, but I think he did seem to be an ordinary sort of person to many people. I mean, there's this lovely story about him personally painting lines in black paint on the baths in Buckingham Palace so that visitors wouldn't use too much hot water, you know, to help the war effort. Oh. You know, the family don't eat off gold plates or anything. I mean, it's And they refused to move to somewhere really safe, like I suppose Balmoral or Sandringham would be much safer. They stayed in Buckingham Palace, and Buckingham Palace was bombed. We must say, however, they didn't sleep there. They slept at Windsor and came back to work at Buckingham Palace for the day. But I think it was terribly important that, and particularly with Queen Elizabeth, who had this marvellous common touch. I mean, she wasn't an ordinary person in many ways. She was very much an aristocratic lady. But I think she had a capacity to link up with people and to empathise. And she says at one point, doesn't she, after Buckingham Palace has been bombed, at last I can look the East End in the face again. So I think that was a nice approach, and I think people appreciated it.
Yeah. So the very fact that they had suffered the same sort of travails as everyone else was kind of... Am I right in thinking that they underwent rationing in some way?
Yes, well? I think they did.
Yeah, which presumably must have been quite strange for
it would have been
king and queen.
Absolutely. I mean, one can't imagine the Tsar of Russia going rationing somehow in similar circumstances. But I mean, yes, I mean, as I say, there was quite a puritanical streak, really, in the family. George VI didn't drink very much. Of course, he did smoke too much, which is why he eventually died prematurely. He didn't bet on the horses or anything. He did enjoy shooting birds and animals in great numbers, but so did other members of the aristocracy and the... upper gentry.
Yeah. So after the war, once the war had been won, he was, you know, he was stood on the balcony and everyone was, you know, waving and applauding. But then he must have found himself in a very difficult situation because the world completely changed after that. You know, there was a Labour government came in and India, you know, with the whole question of what to do with India was suddenly uppermost in people's. So how did he cope with that completely changed pattern of world history?
Well, I think he was the sort of person who did fret over things, and I know that he did fret over the fact that India was to be given its independence and that the world had changed and things weren't as they had been before. But he was also, and I don't know whether Queen Elizabeth plays a part in this, I think he was also sufficiently pragmatic to see that this is how things were. And once the Labour government had been elected, they did not turn out to be the bloodstained Bolsheviks of, you know, of right-wing fantasy. In fact, in many ways, they were quite conservative. I mean, when India got its independence under Labour, of course, in 1947, Narain Bevan, who's the, you know, the extreme left-wing member of the cabinet, somebody says, well, Bevan, like everybody else, hates the thought of giving up India, but there's no option. So it's like, it's more complicated than that, if you see what I mean. So, and also, remember, George VI has worked during the war with many leading members of the Labour government, because they've been in the coalition government. I mean, after he's been Deputy Prime Minister, Morrison's been there, Bevin has been in the coalition government. So he's got to know them and has worked with them. And so they often, it's not like a whole new set of faces and unknown people, which would have, I think that would have made him more insecure. But he works quite well. He's got a great capacity for working with people. He's quite good at, you know, mild jokes and sort of seeing a funny side of things. And he always does his duty. If he says he'll read a paper and comment on it, he'll do it.
Because I suppose he never had a chance to reign in a period of normality, did he? I mean, he came to power in the whole abdication crisis when everyone thought the monarchy was in disarray. Then there was the Second World War, and then the aftermath of the Second World War, and then he died. So he never had a period where, I suppose, it was just like, you know, things were progressing as normal.
No, he didn't really. He was born into a crisis. He became king in a crisis situation, and that got worse and exploded into the Second World War. And then, of course, you had the crisis really of the post-war period, which was about reconstructing British industry, getting the economy back on its feet, facing up to the fact that empire was on the way out and the welfare state was on the way in. And this was an enormous change, but he coped with it. I mean, he had taken an interest in the period when he was not, when he was Duke of York, not King. He had taken an interest in, you know, these boys' camps where middle class and working class boys would gather together annually to sort of get to know each other more and to take part in joint activities and stuff like that. I think he was very obsessed with ritual and correct uniforms and things, and you know, to that extent he probably didn't like some of the more egalitarian ideas behind the Labour government. I mean, I think he was very keen on deference in a modest sort of way. But it does seem to work. He and the Labour government, and particularly he and Attlee, get on extremely well. I mean, they're both people who actually... The King doesn't talk loquaciously, certainly in public, because he still has a bit of a stammer. And Attlee doesn't talk loquaciously because he doesn't like doing it. I mean, he's a one-word, you know, one-liner, one-word man, really. Mm. And they sort of get on. They're two not very loquacious people, really.
Mm. Those boys' camps you mentioned, yes, they seem quite curious. I was reading about them. They, yeah, they have thousands of people, yeah, going to these. And he is a bit like scouts, wasn't it? Yeah. I assume. Didn't he call himself Chief Scout, was it?
No.
But Chief something. Like,
yeah.
That's quite a strange thing for a member of the royal family to be doing, isn't it, at that time? Or actually, is it, personally?
Oh, well, it is and it isn't. I mean, the great thing about the British royal family is that it has managed just, you know, to keep its head above water in terms of not appearing to be completely reactionary and out of touch with everything. And I think there was a lot of poverty in the interwar period. I think one of the establishment's the great worries in the interwar period is that Britain will have its own Bolshevik revolution. You know, the general strike was seen by many people in 26 as a possible harbinger of a revolution. And there were people who wanted a revolution at that point. Mm. Syndicalists and others in the trade union movement, and some on the left of the Labour Party and the Communist Party, of course. And I think that it's a bit noblesse oblige, isn't it? You give some time to underprivileged young people, hoping that that will make an impact on them. And I think the royal tours, which were undertaken by all members of George V's family, really, and on which, of course, George VI had, as Duke of York, had trouble often speaking. But I think these royal tours, both around Britain and also to the Empire and the Commonwealth, are a very important part, again, of sort of cementing the relationship and showing that the monarchy has a human face.
Mm. And that human face line, I suppose, is followed through by his daughter.
Yeah.
What can you see in the way that Queen Elizabeth's reign has demonstrated that she would have taken from her father? Was there any particular aspects?
Oh, absolutely. I think there are several aspects. I mean, I think she's very much her father's daughter. I mean, he might have found Princess Margaret Rose a bit more sparky, and you know, she could play the piano and mimic people. And Elizabeth is rather a serious older daughter, Princess Elizabeth. But I mean, I think she takes from him, first of all, the fact that that family life is terribly important, and that you must do the right thing, and that you must, above all, do your duty as monarch, and that you mustn't push your own views particularly, but you must be there to, you know, to warn, advise, and all the rest of it, the whole Badgett formula. And she does that, I think, extremely well. And the second thing is that she takes very seriously her role as head of the Commonwealth. In fact, the position head of the Commonwealth is more or less created for her when she becomes queen, as the empire turned into the Commonwealth. And I even saw somebody arguing the other day in an article that but for Queen Elizabeth II, the Commonwealth might well have disintegrated and gone its own way in messy bits or chunks. And she, in a way, has kept it together because she really, really believed in it. And she dedicated herself at the age of 21 in South Africa, I think, didn't she, to this great empire Commonwealth of which we are all part. She really believed in the concept of empire Commonwealth and having things in common, good things in common, which would be useful for the nation's future to cherish.
Okay, final question, taking it back to where we started, back to the King's speech. Did Colin Firth get it right? Was the depiction that he provided of George VI an accurate one?
I think Colin Firth is a very, very good actor, of course. I think he was perhaps a little bit more glamorous than George VI normally was, and perhaps a bit more sparky. But I think overall he did get it right. And I think particularly Geoffrey Rush got Lionel Logue right. And when I wrote my biography of George VI, which, as you know, is coming out in a new edition in the new year, I did a lot of work trying to dig up the whole Lionel Logue business. So the King's speech wasn't a surprise to me, of course, at all. And I think he was an incredibly interesting man. And the fact that he dealt with George VI on equal terms, more or less. And, you know, he had this Australian sort of, you know, he didn't call him mate exactly, but, you know, he called him Bertie. And I think Colin Firth did a grand job. I think, as I say, more glamorous than George VI actually was. But the essential insecurities and the bottled up feelings come out. And, I mean, George VI also, of course, before he got his speech defect sorted out in many ways. It was quite irascible. He could explode into sort of incoherent rages when he was a younger man because he couldn't express himself or felt frustrated. People didn't understand him. And I think that came over very well indeed.
We don't always realise just how much our negative thoughts and experiences stick with us and weigh us down. You may find your brain constantly running through a highlight reel of bad moments. That comment your friend made last week that hurt your feelings. That frustrating thing your mum does. Or that silly thing you said in a meeting. Maybe it's time to get it all off your chest. Whether it's a tiny annoyance or something much bigger. Talking about it can give you some relief and lead you to a potential solution. That's where therapy comes in. It's a safe space to share whatever's weighing you down and learn to process it so your internal highlight reel can focus on the good stuff. And BetterHelp offers affordable online therapy on a schedule that works for you. Connect with a licensed therapist by text, phone, or video call. Start the process in minutes and switch therapists anytime. Let it out with BetterHelp. Visit betterhelp.com/historyextra today to get 10% off your first month. That's BetterHelp, HELP.com/historyextra.
This episode is brought to you by Indeed. We're driven by the search for better, but when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/History Extra. Just go to Indeed.com/History Extra right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
Dennis Judd's feature on George VI is in the January issue of BBC History magazine. His book, King George VI, has just been republished by Ivy Torres. Now it's time for our historical trivia moment. This week's piece of trivia has been sent in by Will Koenig, who's a regular listener to the podcast out in Salem, Oregon. Will tells us that before independence, many streets in the Cambodian capital Phnom Penh were named after notable Frenchmen. Following the revolutions, civil wars, and occupation by communist powers, the streets of the city now bear the names of former Cambodian kings and communist luminaries such as Mao Zedong and Kim Jong-il. However, two French street names remain. These are dedicated to Louis Pasteur and to the scientist Albert Calmette. Thanks for that, Will. If anyone would like to email in with further historical facts, we'll gladly read them out here, if they're true, of course, and give you a name check in return. Email us at podcast@historyextra.com with any curious historical facts. Our second interview is with Gus Casely-Hayford, a cultural historian and broadcaster. This month, Gus is presenting the BBC 4 series Lost Kingdoms of Africa, which explores the history of a number of former African states. One of these is the Asante Kingdom in modern-day Ghana, which rose to prominence in the 18th century through its mineral wealth and involvement in the slave trade. As Gus is himself of partly Ghanaian descent, the Asante story has a special resonance for him. I caught up with Gus recently to find out more about this golden kingdom. So we're talking about here the Asante Kingdom. Yes. Whereabouts in Africa is that located?
Okay.
What's that located?
And the Asante, that they are part of the Akan people, who are one of the major West African ethnic groups. And the Asante, that they lived in the interior of what is today Ghana. And the coastal region was peopled by a group called the Fante, and just to the north of them were their cousins, who they were very often at war with, the Asante. And the Asante were very different from the Fante in a variety of ways. They shared the base of a language, but in many other ways they were extremely different. The Asante had huge wealth. The Fante, that they because they were on the coast, that they were fishermen, and over a period of time that their traditions seemed to diverge and they grew to be very, very different and were very often at war.
And you mentioned the huge wealth of the Asante.
Yes.
Is that because of the gold they had in the area?
Yeah, that This is a region which is very heavily forested, and the forest isn't just dense, but also because the weather, the intensity of the humidity is so great, it actually meant that they're very isolated populations. But beneath the soil was incredibly rich deposits of gold, and this is a really, really high quality gold as well. And so from very, very earliest periods, people were aware that the people who lived in this region, in the forests, that they could trade this incredible gold. And it's traded north across the desert and south to the coast. And the Asante, that they grow up in this region amongst a number of different ethnic groups who are all competing for control of this gold.
And when do the Asante first enter the historical record, do we know?
Well, it's difficult. I mean, the Portuguese, that they arrive on the coast in the late 14th century. And they have reports of a number of kingdoms. And it may well be that the forefathers of the Asante were already in the region that the Asante came to inhabit. But at that period, the main kingdom in the interior were the Denchira.
Right.
And the Denchira, that they're very, very powerful and incredibly ruthless. They're not loved by the people that they rule over. They rule over a confederation of smaller kingdoms, and they do so with an incredible sort of ruthless kind of authoritarianism. And people, I mean, because they're isolated, they do rely upon the Denchira for defense, and in lean times they rely on them for resources. But in return for that, the Denchira, that they demand a huge amount, gold particularly, but also men, troops, to fight the ever-expanding ambitions of the Denchira to widen their empire. And one of the kingdoms, or one of the small kingships that sit under the Denchira, are the Asante. And they grow tired, along with all the others, of this bullying administration. And there is a period when basically that there are enough people within the Asante to begin to feel that possibly they could take on the Denchira.
And do we know why it was the Asante rather than any of the other kingdoms that actually took this step in the end?
I think it's a period in which many of these groups are actually, they're actually held together by quite fragile infrastructure, because these territories are isolated, the terrain is incredibly difficult to navigate, and so politically it is possible to cut off people. It is possible to challenge the status quo. But having the guts to do it, when you have a state like the Denchira, who are incredibly ruthless, that they would just literally wipe out their enemies, and they would enslave anyone they could, and, you know, put them they would have put them into forced labour, and that the consequences were so dreadful that many people just wouldn't take them on. But the Asante, that they are ruled by Osei Tutu, who is a young man, and he basically just feels the time is right. You know, I'm going to take these people on. And what he actually uses, he is not just military might, but he uses diplomacy. He uses a chap called Akomfo Anoche, who is, he's a sort of Peter Mandelson type right. figure, you know, a bit of a sort of spin doctor. And what he manages to do is to gradually build a confederation, a coalition of these disaffected sub-states. And they all begin to stand against the dentura. They begin one by one to say, we're not going to stand for it anymore. And when there are enough of them, they take on the dentura. And the consequences of losing are, you know, this is zero sum. You lose and you will be annihilated. But along with their incredible sort of skills at diplomacy, they are great military tacticians, and they beat the dentura and they drive them out of the area. And what the Asante then realize is that they have a very loose confederation that is built up basically because of their shared dislike of the dentura. They don't really share very much more than that. And what they want to do is to build a coherent state. And so that happens in a number of ways. And they are really clever. They decide that they're going to clear the forest. They're going to use the land that they're going to get from the cleared forests to grow crops that will mean that they can support larger numbers of people. That they're also going to bring new people into those cleared areas to then make up a bigger army so that they can protect their region. But additionally, that what they want to do is to deploy those people into things like gold mining and actually working the gold mines. And what the Asante are even more clever at is saying that only the Asantehene can hold wealth. You know, this is a period in which there isn't really fluid currency, that the only people who own things are the aristocracy, and the Asantehene is at the top of this pyramid. And so it's very difficult to challenge the growth of this state. It just continues to grow, accumulating new states and forcing these vassal states into a kind of slavery. And these people would work on the land, clearing the land, growing the Asante state bit by bit. Incrementally, it becomes almost unassailable.
And the Asante gold, is that eventually find its way into, say, European markets?
Well, the Europeans, that they arrive on the coast, the Portuguese, they are eventually displaced by, the French and the Swedes and then the British. And they realise that this bit of the coast is very rich in gold, and that it's worth all of the problems, the encroachments, the ongoing encroachments of the Asante, the difficult weather, and so they begin to trade via their coastal allies, the Fanti, with the Asante for gold. And the gold that comes out of that region is of an incredibly high quality, and huge amounts of it too.
But the Asante also then become involved in slavery as well, and the slave trade.
Yeah, because the Asante, that they are trying to increase their region. They realise that the gold production is also, it demands lots of manpower. And the only way to the only way to man their armies, their gold fields, their farms, is by deploying slaves. And so they expand, and they raid their neighbours, and they use the people that they capture as slaves. But over a period of time, they get so good at this that there's actually a surfeit of labour, and they begin to then trade that labour, and that labour becomes something which is as lucrative almost as the gold trade.
And the slave labor that they're trading, do these people then end up in the Americas, some of them?
Well, the over a period of time, that the British, who consolidate their position on the coast, that they, because of the way in which the trade winds and the tides operate, that they usually sail out from the west coast of Africa west toward the Caribbean. They don't sail direct toward Europe. So there's a trading triangle, and what usually would fill the boats between West Africa and the Caribbean would be people. It would be slaves who would have been captured in the interior in the Asante region, and they would travel down the trade routes to the coast, held usually in castles, huge castles like Cape Coast, which had almost like on an industrial scale sort of areas in their basement which are appalling when you go and you see them, very dark dungeons where people would be held for sometimes weeks at a time, and then from there they go pass through something that would be called the Gate of No Return onto boats, and then from there onto ships, and then out to the Caribbean. And this became an incredibly lucrative trade, you know, possibly 500,000, maybe more, people traveled through Cape Coast on their way to the Caribbean. And it made the Europeans, the British, you know, incredibly wealthy. But at the same time, throughout the 18th century, that there were a number of people who looked at this industry and just said, it's just plainly wrong, morally wrong. And, you know, this was a period in which expansion, money, adventure was obviously kind of, it was important to Britain. But the actual kind of, the actual moral arguments seemed to win the day. And, you know, at the turn of the 19th century, there is this huge move to end slavery and to outlaw it. And the outlawing of slavery completely, it destabilizes the ecology, the local balance on the Gold Coast. Because for the Asante, their whole economy has now been has been refocused around supplying slaves to the coast.
So the Asante essentially prevented the British from having to go into the interior of Africa to get the slaves. They could wait on the coast, and the Asante would bring them the slaves.
Well, if you imagine that these incredibly thick forests and the weather, the strength of the Asante army, that they form a kind of formidable barrier between the coast and the interior, and it is very even with superior weaponry, it is difficult for the British to take on the Asante, and they do. But I think over a period of time, as the British begin to feel more confident about their place on the coast, that they begin to assert themselves, and the Asante get incredibly frustrated at the idea of their old trading relationship with the British being challenged and then dismantled. And so they, you know, they try to continue to trade slaves, even though it's been outlawed. The British block them in a number of instances. And then out of frustration, they actually, the Asante, that they kidnap some Europeans from the coast, from a place called Elmina. And this results in the British actually putting their foot down and forcing the Asante to acknowledge that it really is the end of slavery, and they do that by force.
So the British go into the Asante Kingdom, and am I right, they eventually colonise it?
Well, in 1873, the British, that they do eventually enter the Asante, into Kumasi, the capital. And the Asante, realising that the British have superior numbers, weaponry, that they try at the very last moment to negotiate, but by then it's just too late. And the Santorini, the king's palace, is burnt to the ground. And before this has happened, the kingdom's already begun to unravel because the economy's in tatters, in a sense that the political balance between the king and all of the dignitaries and the aristocracy that surround the king and the merchants that support them is all been about slavery, and it's been about the old system. With the unravelling of that, that the Santorini's power and the respect that he had is beginning to be questioned. And when the British enter Kumasi, razing the palace to the ground, that it seems almost like it is the beginning of the end. But what the British are very clever at is that they don't then declare the Kumasi and the Asante area to be a protectorate. They withdraw, and they actually then declare the coastal area a protectorate. But what they allow is for the Asante region to continue to unravel. And what happens is that it draws down a lot of the mercantile expertise, the wealth, into the British region. People want to begin, rather than to continue to trade with the now what seem like moribund Asante, they want to begin to think about investing in the British, that who seem to be the future.
So it's once they've been able to go and attack the capital, really the Asante's respect is going to be diminished because they couldn't fight off the British at that moment.
Exactly. But at this time, that it feels like it's the end, that the Asante kingdom is going to unravel. And there are consecutive fairly weak Asantehinis, kings. And so even people within the court are beginning to question the viability of the kingdom. But then a woman, Yasantiwa, she has been a member of the royal family, but hasn't really asserted herself before this time. But she steps forward and she petitions for a close relative of hers, Prempeh, to become the Asantehini. And what Prempeh, he's a young man, very young, and that would seem to be kind of not experienced enough. But he is someone who wants to rebuild the Asante stall as it once was. And he wants to focus it again, as it was focused originally, around the traditions that were set up by the founder of the Asante state, Osei Tutu. And what Osei Tutu had been very careful in doing is bringing all of those disparate states together around a number of symbols, things like a golden stool, kente, drumming. These traditions were the things around which the original state actually rallied. And once again, the Asante state begins to grow confident, and it looks to these old symbols as a way of reviving itself. And it seems like for the British, you know, they're thinking, gosh, we thought they were dead in the water. And suddenly it looks like the Asante are growing again in confidence. And it's, you know, unfortunately what happens is that the Asante are unable to actually to deliver, and the British, realizing that they may well be kind of in a position where the balance might shift against them, that they again put pressure on the Asante state. But this time it is devastating, and it does kind of completely mean the end of the kingship. And what they do is to remove the Asantehini. He's not just destalled, but he's sent away. And for a period of time that they try to administer the stall themselves before reinstating it, but then as a stall that is basically just centered around the capital, Kumasi. It's not really about the state. And what the British realized, though, is that even though the Asante state has been completely devastated, it's no longer what it was, either in terms of geography or economics. It still seems to have a kind of residual emotional pull for the local people. And partially that is because the symbols that Osei Tutu, the first Asante Hini, had established of kente, of drumming, but particularly of the golden stool, that they still seem to be of importance. And so they try, the British, to confiscate the golden stool. They asked many times for the golden stool to be given up, and they'd simply refuse. And in the end, they give up a fake one, but they never relinquish the true one. And in a way that when Osei Tutu actually established the Asante stool, what he was very clever, he and Akomfo Anoche, this sort of Peter Mandelson figure, what they're very clever in doing is creating a kind of distance between the holder of the stool and the stool itself. It's the stool that is the important thing. That's where the continuity is invested. And so much of Asante culture is about stories. It's about history. And that history is invested in objects like cloth and like drums, but particularly in the stool. So by keeping the stool, they actually felt that they had kept, in a way, the integrity of the kingship alive. And so even without a king, without a state, without the wealth that they once had, they could still rally around this symbol and feel that the Asante state endured.
And does it still endure today in some respects?
Well, the interesting thing is that the British realised fairly quickly that to administer a state like that, probably the best way of doing it was to reinstate something quite similar. And so over a period of time, they did reinstate the stool. And if you go today, it's not just that the Asante stool is powerful and it's loved, but it works as a political and an economic unit, that the Asante stool still gets money from the gold that is mined in that region. And the Asante goldfields are incredibly rich even today. I had an opportunity to go into one of the gold mines, and the gold that is drawn from the mines every day produces huge ingots. You know, that these ingots are like $1 million each, and that on a single day you can see two or three of these that are produced. And that, you know, I've sat and watched the gold being poured and held one of these ingots, and you get a sense that this isn't just about contemporary economics. There's still a pride in the history that's connected to the gold that's drawn out of the soil. There is an idea that that very place is special. And I suppose in the golden stool is a continuity, not just a connection to the gold, but an idea that the actual authority of the Asante Hini, the rootedness to that place, is something which is fundamental to that state, and that not even in their darkest hours, when the British had seemed to have overrun them, when their economy was smashed, not even then was the golden stool given up. And that is about the integrity of those beliefs, of that history.
What do you see as the legacy of this state? Because obviously there's quite a negative aspect with all the slavery, but also clearly they had quite strong aspects too, and managed to stand up to the British for quite a long time. So how would you view their legacy?
I think their legacy, I mean, if you think about, you know, in Britain, that, I mean, There aren't... Ghana is not, in terms of numbers, that large an African country, but if you look around the world at the influence of Ghanaians, Kofi Annan, you know, if you think about in Britain, politicians like, you know, Boateng, you know, that there is a kind of a tradition of people who have a kind of skill and eloquence that I think is rooted, connected to the way in which history, in which telling of stories, in which the keeping of folklore is so important. And I think in a way that the legacy that against this incredible landscape, this very, very difficult environment, against all of those odds, what they were so keen to do was to keep alive the story, the history. And in Ghanaians today, there is still that sense that history, that story is absolutely vital. And so even for those slaves that were cast out over the ocean into the new world, the thing that still seems to survive are those stories that, you know, you travel in the Caribbean or the New World, and it is the stories, you know, Brer stories, the stories of Anansi. These are stories that actually travelled with them, with slavery. And in a way, the legacy is the story, the history. And I think for a people who began with stories, I think, you know, that's very fitting.
I mean, I remember those stories when I was growing up. I had no idea they came from Ghana originally.
Yes, those are stories that travelled with slavery. And if you think about so much slavery was about completely trying to eradicate the past and getting people to completely inculcated with a kind of Euro-American sensibility. Some of it was just so important to those people that they held on to it. And those stories of, it's not just of origin, but the Anansi stories particularly of tricksters, of railing against possibility and authority, that in a way that is partially the Asante way of trying to find ways out of a situation. And, you know, if you think about the golden stool, that even when they did have their backs up against the wall, that they did manage to find a way to survive.
That was Gus Catesley-Hayford. Look out for Lost Kingdoms of Africa on BBC Four this month. Gus has also written a piece on the Asante Kingdom in our January issue. Well, that's all for this week's episode. I hope you'll join us again next week, where we'll be discussing consumer laws in early modern Germany and how ancient Egypt impacted on Victorian Britain. BBC History Magazine's weekly podcast is recorded in Bristol and produced by the rambunctious Dave Gibson. Thanks for listening.